I'm Bob Kinzel, co-host of Vermont Edition. Just wanted to let you know that this has been edited for brevity.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Over the last year, Vermont's Agency of Education has been undertaking a review of what the state spends and where it spends it when it comes to special education. It's an illuminating report, if not totally surprising. Vermont's supervisory unions spend, on average, 1.5 to 2 times more than the national average on special education. But there's one particular area of the report that gave us special pause. The report reads as follows. Vermont's special education population has the largest share of students with emotional disturbance of any state in the nation, and nearly 3 times the averages seen in neighboring states. The share of Vermont students with other health impairments also exceeds the national average, but is on par with neighboring states. That phrase, emotional disturbance, is not one that's universally familiar, and the fact that Vermont places a far higher percentage of its students than other states in this category deserves some scrutiny. So today on the program, we're going to take a look at what emotional disturbance means in this context, and how it's treated at school and beyond. Where are we doing well? Are children still falling through the cracks? And is there a way to spend less but get better results? We're joined for this discussion by Dylan McNamara, co-director of Student Support Services at the Essex-Westford School District and a member of the Vermont Council of Special Educator Administrators. Dylan, it's a pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
We're also joined by Jesse Suter, interim director of the Center on Disability and Community Inclusion at the University of Vermont. Jesse, it's nice to have you on the program.
Thanks so much.
So let's give a little bit of numerical context to this conversation. About 16% of Vermont students, K through 12, have been identified for special education. Now, that's a little higher than the national average of 13%, but not much. And it's actually pretty on par with where our neighboring states are. It's this special category of emotional disturbance where Vermont is an outlier. 18% of special education students are in this emotional disturbance category, and that is very much higher than the national average and higher than our neighboring states. Now, I definitely want to get into why we're so much higher than other states, whether it's a question of labeling or a question of wanting to treat more students or if it's an actual higher rate of emotional disturbance. But first, let's try to define what this term emotional disturbance means in the educational setting. Jesse Suter, can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I think one important thing is I'm not a special educator, so I don't do eligibility determinations and don't have that background. So, Dylan, when I start line, please jump in.
Sure thing.
So it's a very broad category, and there's really 5 main areas that are looked at in order to get this label or for make a determination for it. So first, an inability to learn that cannot be explained by other factors like intellectual, sensory, or health factors. An inability to build or maintain satisfactory interpersonal relationships. Inappropriate types of behavior under normal circumstances. That's a very broad category. Another is a general pervasive mood of unhappiness or depression and a tendency to develop physical symptoms or fears associated with personal or school problems. So if a student is judged as having difficulties in any of those areas, coupled with it occurring over a long period of time, coupled with it negatively impacting how they're doing at school, that's when folks should be considering this label.
Dylan McNamara, can you give me an example? I mean, obviously, we're not naming names. We're not trying to reveal the privacy of any families. But can you put us into a school setting here and, you know, what kinds of behaviors are kids exhibiting and how it's affecting their ability to learn in a classroom setting?
Sure. And it can manifest in several different ways if you look at the criteria that Jesse just reviewed. It's not atypical to have a student that is experiencing high levels of anxiety and or depression. And due to that, they struggle participating in class with their peers. They struggle attending. They struggle at times regulating their emotions. And those collectively create a lot of challenges for the student. And if those challenges exist for a long period of time and impact the academic progress, that student may be identified. We typically see students with both internalizing challenges, like the anxiety and the depression, and students with more externalizing challenges like behavioral outbursts and those types of things.
And this is separate from something like ADHD or other areas where a student might have issues with behavior but that are not considered emotional disturbance?
Yeah, there are some differences. We often do see concurrent challenges with students. But ADHD is an example of a disability that would fall under the category of other health impairment in the state of Vermont. This category of emotional disturbance is really specific to the criteria that Jesse reviewed.
And the criteria, you don't have to have all of them. You can have one and be classified in this category.
Yep, any one for an extended period of time that causes adverse effect. Yes.
We did get a note from a parent who says, thank you very much for addressing this. My daughter is now a junior in high school and was diagnosed with an emotional disturbance midway through her sophomore year. She had been struggling with paralyzing depression and anxiety that prevented her from attending school since the fall of her ninth grade year. Not only did it take more than a year for the school system to suggest and complete the appropriate testing and get her on an IEP, an individual education program, but today she is still not in an appropriate program, so she's been out of school for 2 years. So there's an example of some of the struggles. Kenny writes, as a special educator for the past 24 years, I've developed my own theories as to the causes of what sometimes seems like an epidemic of students eligible for special education services due to the presence of an emotional disturbance. I believe that we are dealing with the aftermath and fallout of an economy that has devastated struggling families. We serve students that have endured neglect by overstressed parents, abuse by adults, substance abuse fallout, abject poverty and homelessness, and economic hardship, hunger, lack of proper clothing and heat. The results are kids with no hope, no support, and often significant anger, and who can blame them? Jesse Suter, do you think those are the root causes of emotional disturbance, or some of them at least, in Vermont schools?
There's no question that stress like that can absolutely contribute. One of the things that we – so my background, my field is psychology, although I'm not a practicing psychologist, and there's been decades of research trying to understand the why factor. And one of the things that we know from a lot of research is that kids can end up in the same difficult circumstances with completely different backgrounds and vice versa. So kids can have the same negative or even traumatic experiences and turn out very differently. So when we're trying to name, you know, a single or a set of root causes for something like this, it becomes incredibly difficult, especially trying to talk about a reason for statewide. Those all seem like very reasonable potential reasons. I think others in Vermont are ultimately, you know, people are making decisions about choosing this disability category as the primary disability category versus something else. So what we know from these numbers that you shared is that Vermont, folks in Vermont tend to do that more often than other states. And so I wouldn't want to lose the idea that it's humans making this decision. And I think there's other reasons for that.
Let's go to a call here from Michael in Cambridge. Hi, Michael. You're on the air. Go right ahead. Hi, Michael.
So I've been teaching for 6 years. I've got a master's in curriculum instruction. And in my first position, I spent quite a bit of time in a public school, but with a high percentage of students who had experienced some severe trauma, neglect, abuse, other sorts of things like that. And having done a lot of research on this, I find that students who experience some severe trauma tend to be stuck at younger developmental ages than their peers, but are expected to do the same kind of work as peers at their same age level. And instead of focusing on social and emotional skills, which these students severely lack, they are continually sort of almost oppressed by standards that are almost unreasonable for their peers, but are especially unreasonable for them. And it's tough as a teacher to watch that, to know that these students need a stable environment and need to work on those emotional skills, but instead are being asked to do work that is well beyond what they are prepared for. And that is, as a teacher, incredibly disheartening.
Well, Michael, I appreciate you sharing your experience with this. Jesse Suter, Dylan, let's go to you. Dylan McNamara, I mean, do you see what Michael's seeing?
Well, I think we certainly see that students who have experienced trauma and adverse childhood experiences struggle with emotional regulation and struggle with other aspects of life that make it difficult in school. What school districts across the state are doing is they're pursuing training and support for their staff around how to recognize trauma, how to understand trauma, and more importantly, how to foster resilience in students. But clearly, there are competing demands, I'm sure, for teachers as they work to support students' master academic curriculum as well as address social emotional needs.
And I'd love to direct listeners as well to a program we did recently on resilience, on building resilience in students and in a generation of students who are struggling with some of these similar issues, whether they're actually being identified for special education and emotional disturbance or not, that this is something that many students are dealing with. And in fact, many schools are also dealing with how to build resilience in all of their students. And again, listeners, if you'd like to participate in this show, our number is 800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post your notes on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. We got a note from Mark who says, because Vermont has the highest rate of identification of students with emotional disturbance, it makes me wonder how our process for classifying and identifying these children differs from other states that don't have such a high rate. I'm not saying that Vermont is doing it wrong or that it's bad, but only that I suspect that there must be significant differences in criteria to classify these special ed kids compared to other states. Jesse Suter, you were sort of touching on that a moment ago. Do we just do it differently rather than have more students who are experiencing emotional distress?
So ultimately, it's coming down to an individual that's making that decision. So the data does bear that out. Our rates of labeling kids as the primary disability category of emotional disturbance is higher. In terms of the process, and Dylan can speak more to that in special education, but there, one of the things I was alluding to earlier when talking about the human element to making those decisions is, teachers, special educators, certainly parents, and certainly kids all want kids to succeed in schools. And so when we're even going through a special education identification process, we're thinking about what do these students need? And in Vermont, there's been, for many decades now, an investment in mental health and community mental health supports outside of schools and in schools. And so knowing that those supports are available, one of the things that I wonder and has been raised about this before is if this is a pathway, if students have needs with emotional behavioral challenges, this label can help them get access to services as well. I really, when we think about, all of the adverse childhood experiences, like Dylan talks about, we experience that in many different states. And some states arguably have higher rates than us, but lower rates for identification with ED. So again, I'd just be really careful that it's really hard to know exactly why it's higher. I think a related discussion, and I'm happy to hold it, is I think there's actually a much larger group of students with emotional behavioral challenges that need supports in schools, just not only from special education.
Right. And in fact, that is exactly what we were talking about a couple of weeks ago, because there is this sense that kids aren't necessarily getting the supports they need or the independence they need or the resilience they need. And it's interesting to see this across the board in students, but then specifically related to this category of emotional disturbance. If we do look at the special education numbers, and Dylan McNamara, I was saying at the beginning of the show, Vermont's rate is a little bit higher than the national average and slightly higher than some of our neighbors when it comes to how many students are categorized or identified for special education at all. But within the special education category, we are much, much higher on emotional disturbance.
We are.
And if you, so I guess you have to either suggest or discard the premise that Vermont has a much higher rate of emotional disturbance in our children than other states. And Jesse was just talking about how some other states may, in fact, have a higher rate of emotional disturbance. So if we take as the premise that we don't have a three times as high rate of emotional disturbance in Vermont as we do in other New England states, why is this category more appealing to Vermont and to Vermont educators than it is to other states? What is having a categorization of emotional disturbance either give to a child in terms of needs or give to a school district in terms of money that is appealing?
Right. Those are good, great questions. And I'll build on that and what Jesse said a little bit too. I do not believe that Vermont actually has 2 to 3 times more students with emotional and behavioral challenges than the other states around us. What I do think there is a difference in how we perceive this and how we determine students are eligible for this. Along with the criteria that Jesse reviewed, there's also an exclusionary clause around social maladjustment. And so the regulations from the federal government and the state rules do state that if a student has a social maladjustment that's different than emotional disturbance, they may not be eligible. Social maladjustment, without going into too much detail, generally covers students with oppositional, defiant behaviors that are perceived as more just deviant versus connected to underlying emotional challenges. I've worked and I've been in other areas of our country where it feels like those states sort of rely on that exclusionary clause, or they focus on that more so. I think in Vermont, we do a better job of understanding and recognizing and appreciating that even when a student acts out behaviorally and we're only seeing externalized challenges, that there are underlying emotional and behavioral issues as well. And so I do think that's a factor.
And that's actually one of the areas where having this categorization is helpful for a student, right? Because if you have emotional outbursts that if you don't have this IEP that says that you are categorized with emotional disturbance, you're more likely to be suspended. You're more likely to be removed from class for what would be seen as behavior that's unacceptable in a classroom. Whereas if this category of emotional disturbance is applied, that's taken into consideration in your behavior, right?
Yeah. Well, if it's determined that you qualify for special education, there are some protections, absolutely, and supports that would be provided that may not otherwise be provided. I also think, alluding to what Jesse said, there are some other things that folks are entitled to. In Vermont, legislation referred to as Act 264 was passed in 1988, and that entitled children and families to interagency coordination and support plans. Didn't promise the delivery of services, but it did provide a structure to have interagency discussions. It is interesting to note that in 1988 that was passed, our numbers of students with emotional disturbance hovered around upper 800s, 891 and
you're talking raw numbers, not percentages here.
Exactly, 191 students. And then between 1989 and 2000, we went up from 891 to 2,000 students. So we doubled in the 10 years that followed that legislation, not because I think we were trying to identify students only because that legislation existed, but I think it did force us to pay attention to the needs of students and families and did provide a bit of an incentive to make sure that we're appropriately identifying students.
We're talking today about emotional disturbance. It's a category listed within special education, and many Vermont students, you know, about 18% of students who are identified for special education find themselves in that category. We're talking about why. We're also going to be looking at what supports these students get both inside and outside of the classroom, because obviously this is something that extends beyond the classroom and families need support. And so are they getting it and what are they getting? We've gotten emails and calls as well from educators and parents. We got this email from a listener who says, I wish I could participate in the discussion, but I work in a public high school and will be busy working with students with emotional disturbance. So this person has written in, the school I work in has a high percentage of students who have survived a trauma and who live in poverty. I do think there's a high correlation between emotional disturbance and poverty. Many of the students were born addicted to crack and or live with parents currently struggling with addiction. One thing I'd like your listeners to know is that special educators, teachers, and school counselors work hard in your public schools to serve all students, and students with emotional disturbance take up a lot of energy and time. I can honestly say that my coworkers and I are running from 7:30 a.m. until after school hours to serve students and families. And this teacher also goes on to say, Secretary Holcomb's proposal to increase the number of students per teacher in classes is not the answer. I'm Jane Lindholm. This is Vermont Edition. Today we're looking at children who fit into a special education category called emotional disturbance and how that's addressed in Vermont schools. We're talking with Jesse Suter, who is interim director of the UVM Center on Disability and Community Inclusion, and Dylan McNamara, co-director of Student Support Services at the Essex-Westford School District and a member of the Vermont Council of Special Educator Administrators. And let's go to Michael, who's calling in from Saratoga, New York. Hi, Michael. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I have an experience myself that my daughter, and well, I should say my wife, actually did all the, you know, fighting to get the IEP for my daughter who has ADHD. But I think, you know, in my background actually is a school bus driver. So I think that it's too hard, especially for the kids that don't have a good, stable family at home. And to have somebody that fights for them to get them what they need where they do get in trouble, you know, in school and they get suspended or they get thrown out. And I think it's just frustration, I believe, you know. And I've, like I said, firsthand seen it with my daughter, which, and since she's gotten her IEP, she's doing excellent in school. You know, it's, and it's just good to see, you know, and I think we have to make it easier, to get the kids, you know, but I think parents are afraid to label their children too. So yeah, that's a thing, that's a fear factor, I think, on their side.
Michael, thanks for your perspective. Really appreciate hearing it. And let's go now to Martha, who's calling in from Williston. Hi, Martha.
Good afternoon. My name's Martha Frank, and I'm a family consultant at Vermont Family Network. We are the State Parent Training Information Center. I'm also a parent and a licensed special educator, and I'd like to weigh in on the discussion and offer a perspective on what we see here with the families that reach out to us. We find that many students are labeled with an emotional disturbance because that's the most some of the concerns they have are the most presenting issues, when actually those students may have underlying learning disabilities that are unsupported or undiagnosed. We also find that we have many families who receive late diagnoses of autism spectrum disorders when initially they are labeled with emotional disturbance. And I do think it has a lot to do with how we look at adverse effect in our state and making sure that those students get the appropriate supports. Oftentimes, our students with learning disabilities, when those needs go unmet, students do develop anxiety, depression, and some form of an emotional disturbance that is how they qualify. So I would like to see greater emphasis on the evaluation process that takes place in schools, and I'm very appreciative that the Agency of Education has done some great webinars to really help identify what are the underlying causes that someone's having difficulty, and making sure that those students receive the supports that they need so they don't develop secondary concerns.
Martha, I really appreciate you sharing your perspective. And Dylan McNamara, somebody who works with students, I'd love to hear what you think of what Martha's
talking. Martha, I think those are great points. It is important for listeners to understand that it's a licensed psychologist or psychiatrist that should weigh in and needs to weigh in on whether or not there's the presence of an emotional disturbance. But it's a tricky evaluation. It should be a very comprehensive evaluation, and it should consider other contributing factors, not just behaviors that are manifesting at that time. I do think if you look across the state, we do still have a range from anywhere from 10% of students on IEPs up to 30% of students on IEPs who may be identified. And sometimes those differences are accounted for by demographic explanations. Other times they're not. We look at some neighboring districts that have very different numbers, and that speaks to the subjectivity that is involved in the evaluation, despite the criteria, as well as perhaps at times a lack of comprehensive assessment that considers all the contributing factors.
So do you think school districts, administrators, licensed professionals, is there something that they should be doing better, or is the system working?
Well, there's a lot of aspects to that question. In terms of assessments, I think there's always room for improvement in terms of the comprehensive nature of the assessment and early identification. I think that's a collective effort that we all could continue to work on. In terms of how we serve students, that's, you know, I think we're working really hard there, and we're going to get into that, I think, in a bit. But there's more that could be done collectively, I think, not just from school personnel and school staff, but community mental health and other wraparound services need to be present if we're going to have the impact that we want with students and the families.
Well, let's get into some of that, and let's go to Selah, who's calling in from Rochester. Hi, Selah. Go right ahead.
Hi. I have a degree in psychology, and I've also worked as a Montessori school teacher before I finished my degree. And something that really needs to be addressed, I think, is the home lives and the families of the kids, because they don't just learn these habits out of the blue with emotional disturbances. A lot of them are abused somewhere. And family counseling would also be a great thing to include, and have these conversations about how you're treating it at home, no matter, for the whole school, because some kids don't even show symptoms, but they're being abused. and they show symptoms later on in life.
Yeah, Selah, I appreciate your perspective. Thanks for bringing that up. And Jesse Suter, you know, this is one of the areas where this identification of emotional disturbance is not something that just manifests in school. And as Selah talks about, not something that can just be tackled in a school setting. So what kind of wraparound care or care for the family, support for a family is there for students who in the school system are identified as having emotional disturbance?
It's a great question, and it's a huge area of need. And I really appreciate Selah's point. I think one quick follow-up that I want to make to that is certainly not all students that are struggling with emotional behavioral challenges have experienced abuse or trauma. And I was so pleased that Martha was able to speak from the Vermont Family Network and family point of view before. I think when schools are most successful, especially when they're trying to use approaches like wraparound, is when they have strong relationships with the families. And so even when families have experienced a tremendous amount of stress or poverty or discrimination, all of that stress at home absolutely affects how students are doing at school and even whether or not they're labeled. And it's even more important for schools to and other providers to have strong relationships with those family members as the stress goes up. It's important for any family and for any student in school. It's even more important for these kids and families that are struggling. So I just want to emphasize that families aren't to blame. We need them as partners. In fact, that's really what the core feature of wraparound is. Very briefly, since you asked about wraparound is a very intensive and coordinated process for bringing a student with their family and other natural supports in their lives, like friends, other family members, perhaps a coach or someone else in their lives who knows them well and can support them at school and outside of school with the necessary professionals that are needed to meet the specific needs. And then really how it's different from a lot of more traditional approaches is you really try and listen to the family and the student first. So what do they need? What are they saying their immediate strengths are that can be leveraged to support what their needs are? And then you couple that with, you integrate that with the services that are needed and, of course, that are available and can be supported. So it's a very powerful process. One addition to that that I'd like to say, that's an approach that is used in community mental health centers outside of schools. It's also an approach that at our center we've got the statewide positive behavior interventions and supports network, and that's something that we try and help schools have the capacity and competencies to offer in school as well. And the last point I want to make about that is it works most effectively when it's in a broader model that supports all students. So, Jane, as you were talking earlier about building resiliency, and some of the callers are talking about the need to reach these students earlier in the process, we really need general education and special education and our community services working together in a continuum of supports. We got to provide positive promote behavioral health and social emotional learning for all students, because that's going to help reduce the number of students that need more intensive services like wraparound.
You know, it's interesting, though, what we hear again and again is that there are so many pressures, financial pressures, emotional pressures, all kinds of pressures on families and on schools. And, you know, part of the idea of wraparound care is that in certain circumstances, the Department for Children and Families might get involved. But we know that social workers with DCF are already stressed and have huge caseloads. And even adding more staff has not enabled them to keep pace. So, you know, from your perspective, Dylan, working in the school systems, you know, are we getting there? Because, you know, in some ways, there's not enough care that could actually be thrown into this mix to give kids the stability they need. On the other hand, we are still facing these financial pressures, and we're spending a lot of money. You know, there's so many threads, but you know, I think the idea is, are we actually giving families the support they need through this system?
Right. I think school districts are working very hard to provide the support that students and families need. I do believe there's a lot of work to do. I don't believe it's due to lack of effort. I think the resources are strained. What we know is that even when you have proactive early intervention systems in place, there are students that need intensive supports. Those supports need to be in collaboration, I think, with community agencies, other family wrap services that support students and families outside the schoolhouse. And you know, what I've observed over the years is that those resources have been thinned out over time and that they're strained. And so it's not uncommon for us to initiate an interagency team and identify a number of supports that a student and a family needs. And it's not uncommon to have a significant waiting list for those services. And so, again, everybody is at the table. I think they have an appreciation and understanding of what needs to be done often, but we often don't have the access to those supports and services. And I think it's challenging to expect schools in the 6.5 to 7 hours a day to impact the level of change that and support that needs to do if they're doing it alone. And I think the wrap that Jesse speaks of, that model is critical. And I do think we need more support and resources to support that approach.
So is it just more money? I mean, the Agency of Education report that just came out that identifies special education funding says that for students with emotional disturbance, on average, it costs more than double what it costs to educate a student who's not receiving special education services and emotional disturbance services. So we're already spending double. And mm-hmm. what you're saying is we're still not necessarily getting as far as we need. So is it more money or do we need to change the system?
I do think we need to look at the funding system and the approach. I think we need some flexibility in how we use those funds so that we're not directed to use them in a reactive way. We need to be able to invest some funds in a more proactive, flexible way up front. I think we need to invest in systems that Jesse talks about, PBIS and other structures. I also think we need the expertise. Despite often knowing what to do, we don't always have the trained interventionists on staff to implement plans. And I think that's not too uncommon around the state. And I believe there needs to be a shift. So it can't all fall on schools. And so if I say that there's no more resources and money, it's not necessarily just pouring that into the schools, but it's looking at the community agencies and how do we support and fund them so that they can provide the support that we've all identified that families need.
Jesse, you know, one of the other questions is we're a small state. As we all know, we have very small schools. And when you have a small school and you have a small number of students and, you know, each school is trying to make sure that they have all the professionals on hand to help their students, I mean, that costs a lot of money. Is it a factor of us being a small school with small a small state with small schools that's also having an effect on the cost and our effectiveness?
Absolutely. I mean, access to resources is always an issue. And certainly in more rural areas, it's very difficult to get that access to the expertise you need. And that's why it underscored the point, Dylan, you were making about, you know, increasing the competencies and skills of a broader range of school staff. You know, just as I was emphasizing families before, the critical role of teachers as the people that know their students the best, the better we can help our classroom teachers to support students that are at risk, both academically and behaviorally, really can't be undersold. That's really critically needed for this. And I'm not an economist, so I shouldn't be speaking about the finance aspects of this, but I will say there's been some good research to say investment in this area does have long-term returns. However, it might not be in the special education. So special education might be making the investment and the savings might be in child welfare or juvenile justice or in our tax base as people are able to get higher paid jobs and good outcomes. So to me, it really just underscores we have to look at this as a more holistic issue and we have to work together.
Well, it's interesting to think about and very interesting to learn a little bit more about. Thanks to both of you for being on the program today. Really appreciate your expertise and insight.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for having us and thanks for focusing on this.